Hello, 13th Jurors. Brandi Churchwell here, and I'm back with a brand new trial for y'all. This week, we head back to Colleton County, South Carolina. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's because that is where we spent week upon week at the beginning of this year as we went through the trial of Alex Murdaugh. Now, the judge for Alex Murdaugh trial is Judge Clifton Newman, and I just fell in love with him. I love the way he runs his court. He is efficient and he's fair. I love how he takes his time to explain his rulings and he puts thought into it. He is truly one of my favorite judges, and I love the way he runs the room. So the good news is we've got Judge Newman. The bad news is this is a tough trial, y'all. This one is not going to be a long one, so this series will only be a couple of episodes. But I wanted to cover it because Christina deserves to have her story told. So let me give you a little bit of background. Christina is a beautiful 13-year-old child. She loves SpongeBob and Dora the Explorer. She loves swimming and horses. She was born with cerebral palsy, so she is confined to a wheelchair, and she's nonverbal, so she can't really communicate. But everybody who knows her said that she was very capable of showing emotions. You could always tell when she was happy or sad. Christina's mom is Rita Pangalangan. Now, Rita was a teacher, and she had actually been voted Teacher of the Year in 2014. She and Christina's father were no longer together, so she was dating the co-defendant in this trial, Larry King. In August of 2019, Rita had brought Christina over to Larry's house. She and Christina spent the night there, and at some point in the next morning, an argument arose between Rita and Larry because apparently Rita had been cheating on him. Apparently, he asked her to leave, and when she was planning on leaving about 11:15 in the morning, Larry actually carried Christina out to her car and put her in the rear driver's side seat. He opened the door, put her inside, and then continued an argument or conversation or whatever you want to call it between him and Rita. Now, that was about 11:15 in the morning. The details of what was happening in that moment and what happened next are what are pretty much going to be debated during this trial. But the bottom line is they put Christina in the car and they continued to talk. They hung out on the front porch swing. They argued. They went inside and made up, all while Christina was in the car. Almost 4 hours pass before they actually try to open the door on the car, and it looks like the car doors are locked and the key fob is inside, so she can't get inside anymore. Now, keep in mind, this is 4 hours later. Christina has been sitting in this car for 4 hours. It's almost another 2 hours before the doors are actually opened and Christina is out. By this time, she is dead. Toxicology reports show that there was methamphetamine in the system of both Rita and Larry. They were arrested and charged with Christina's death. Now, as a side note and kind of a little ironic twist here, Rita has two other daughters and one of them has young children. It was about a week after Rita's arrest where her other daughter was actually arrested in a Walmart parking lot. There's always a Walmart involved in every trial, y'all. But her daughter was arrested in a Walmart parking lot a week later. And the reason? Locking her kids in the car. Now, she says to officers when she comes out that she was only in there for 5 minutes. But they know that's a lie because they had been at the car waiting on her for about 15 minutes. Now, this is like Charleston area at 1 o'clock. In August, and it was about 90 degrees at this time. The car was locked and the air was running, but like I said, blowing hot air. But one of the other problems is the back window was busted out and it just had plastic over it. Now, I don't know if y'all have ever tried to cool off a car or a shed or anything that has a window busted out in the summer in the South when you're just putting plastic over it. But it's not possible. You can't keep that cool. And to leave those kids in there, who, by the way, were only 7 years old and 6 months old, it's dangerous and it's stupid. And she should have known better, especially a week after her mama got locked up for the death of her sister. So that brings us to this trial. Now, like any trial, before we can get started, there are always going to be some pre-trial motions that are filed and things that need to be ruled on. One thing is the defense does not want any of the drug use to come in and for the jury to hear any of that. Now, the tox screens for Larry and Rita were both positive for methamphetamine and amphetamine. And they said that they don't want this coming in because it doesn't have anything to do with Christina's death. Judge Newman disagrees. He says that this is admissible because it occurred during res geste and could also show the state of mind of the defendants. And he says it's more probative than prejudicial, so the jury needs to hear it. There's also a motion for the solicitor's openings to be limited, and that's also denied. There's a motion for the former babysitter's statement to be not admissible, and that one is also overruled because it can go toward the lack of accident or the state of mind of the defendants. There's also a motion about an expert witness for a key fob, and that one is granted. So that one will actually be excluded. There will be no expert testimony about key fobs, and you'll hear more about this later. Now, opening statements start with the state, and the solicitor is none other than Mr. Duffy Stone. If you recognize the name, it's because of his ties to Alex Murdoch. Now, if you remember, he is the one who actually refused to recuse himself from the case of Alex Murdoch and the double murder trial for the deaths of Paul and Maggie Murdoch. I'll give y'all kind of a Cliff's Notes version of all this, but basically, he is not only kind of a protege of Dick Harpootlian, who was representing Alex Murdoch in his trial, but also there was a lot of criticism around Stone. And keep in mind, this is 14th Circuit. So this is like his dude here. This is Alex Murdoch is a badge carrying member of Duffy Stone's office. So why would he not recuse himself? But he didn't want to at first. It's not over there though. Alan Wilson and Creighton Waters were wanting to kind of get in on the Alex Murdoch thing, and here's why. After the alleged boat crash cover-up, they are already investigating Alex, so they already have been looking into him. So this is one more branch of Murdoch drama that they want in on because they want to see if and how it relates to anything else they're already investigating. At this point, the court has already approved several subpoenas. There's been a statewide grand jury in Columbia, and this has kind of also led to the investigation into Alex Murdoch's financial crimes. So they're all up in this already. So why would a prosecutor who has an obvious conflict of interest when it comes to Alex Murdoch somehow be the one to prosecute his trial over a prosecutor who was already investigating Alex for something else? It doesn't make sense, obviously. But eventually he does step back after that interview that Alex Murdoch did, where they bring up the video of him by the tree and the Snapchat video and all of the things that made that trial so infamous. So fast forward a few years. Here we are. Opening statements, Duffy Stone is up to bat. Now, he keeps it kind of short and sweet because this is not a difficult or complicated trial. I mean, there's not a lot of evidence and there's not a lot of extra details that go into anything. It's pretty cut and dry. So his opening statement is not very long. So he keeps it simple. He basically tells the jury, this is a hot August day. It's 11:15 when it's just starting to get hot in August in South Carolina. It's already at that point 89 degrees outside of the car. He tells the jury that Rita and Larry were together and take Christina outside, put her in the car where she is left for about 5 hours and 45 minutes. He explains that the inside of the car reached a temperature of about 118 degrees with a heat index of 135 degrees. The child's temperature was 109.9 degrees when the coroner took her report, and that's only because that's as high as their thermometer would go. Her brain gave up, her organs shut down, there were blisters on her body, and she died in the back of that car. The technical reason was hyperthermia from heat exhaustion. And he says they treated her like baggage. They were high on meth, put her in the car. They're just swinging on the swing, hugging, kissing, all of which he tells the jury, you'll see in the video. And then they go inside the house and stay for hours. They put her in the car like a suitcase and then just left her. Now, Rita and Larry are being tried together. So they're being tried at the same time, but they are using different attorneys. So this is going to be a little bit of a different trial than what we're used to. So there's actually going to be two opening statements from defense and two cross-examinations and so on. So the first up is the attorney for Larry King. I would love to play y'all some clips from the openings, but none of the attorneys stayed anywhere near a microphone, so the audio is really bad. But I promise I will have some clips later. You won't just have to hear my voice the whole time. So Larry's attorney tells the jury that you are required to keep an open mind during this procedure and listen to the testimony as it comes. He says that Rita and Larry had broken up and then they'd gotten back together, which was the biggest mistake that Larry ever made. Now, I'm no expert, but you are sitting here as a defendant in a murder trial of a child, so I think that possibly getting back together with that woman wasn't the biggest mistake he had ever made, and I think it's kind of a slap in the face to basically everybody who gives a damn about this child that he even said that. But I digress. He continues on and says that morning he had confronted Rita about being unfaithful, and they were basically kind of going back and forth about it. He asked her to leave, so he went and got Christina and put Christina in the car. He put her in feet first, and then he said, "Mom steps away." Now, I want y'all to hear this clip, and like I said, the audio is not great. I apologize for that, but I'm going to try to clean it up as much as I can. But this is one of those things I think is important to hear.
She's not his child. She's not his adopted child. He doesn't pay his board. He doesn't bathe or wash her. He doesn't feed her. He's not financially responsible for it.
So that basically sums up their entire argument that wasn't his child. It doesn't matter if he's the one who put her in the car and he knew that she was in the car that whole time and he's in there getting it on with her mama. That doesn't matter because that's not his child. He's not financially responsible for her. He don't bathe her. And that is not his child. Now, this is infuriating to hear because, you know what? He's right. That's not his child and not his responsibility. But it is a human responsibility to get a child who cannot fend for themselves out of trouble if they are in trouble. So I don't like this whole opening statement and I don't like where it's going. But it continues. He says that the car was running when he put Christina in the car. He said that then they walk into the house sometime later. Rita comes out, goes to the car, checks on Christina, and then gets in the front seat momentarily, then goes back inside, comes out another time later. And he said after about 2 hours, they come out and the car is locked with her in it and they're trying to get into it. Now, his timing is off, but we'll get into more of that later. He says that Larry's trying to help. He offers to break the window and she says no, that it'll just be cheaper to run to her house and get the other key fob. He said that they go get the key fob and they come right back and mom opens the door and they find the child dead. He says that once he put the child in the car, then she became mom's responsibility. He wraps it up by debating about conspiracy and if Mr. King should actually be considered for conspiracy. And he makes a statement about how that means that they have to look it together and say, how are we going to murder this child? Obviously, there's an objection because obviously he's making that up. And they sustain the objection that Judge Newman actually tells them, I will instruct you on what conspiracy means. This is not going well for the defense so far. Next up is Mr. Phillips, the attorney for Rita. Now he gets up and he says that he is a father and he knows that losing a child is a parent's worst nightmare. He says this is a tragedy and mistakes were made and things should have been done differently. But he tells the jury that they have a chance to do this the right way, to listen to evidence. He said she's not guilty of murder. Yes, she should have done things differently and that is her living nightmare every day. But he said this is not a murder case. He said he won't make excuses, and he knows that this evokes raw emotion, and that won't be downplayed. But he says the government has to show that she's guilty of murder beyond a reasonable doubt. And he says that there's zero evidence of conspiracy. He said the person who hurts worse is Rita. He also points out that she has a master's degree and she's a teacher. So now we start with witnesses, and we move through witnesses pretty fast. The first one is Hallie Godley. She is an agent for SLED, or South Carolina Law Enforcement Division. She was one of the first on the scene, and she said that when she responded, she saw two legs sticking out of tall grass. She said she pulled in, and she saw Christina face down in the grass, and Larry was walking around the yard. She said the front door to the residence was open, and Mom was nowhere near her. She said Mom was actually inside. And she said that's how she was. That's how it was when she got there. It was a really sad scene. Now, the defense objects to the responder's photos being shown because he says that they show her emaciated and in a diaper and face down, and that they will make the jury feel prejudiced against the defendants. The state says this is reality. This is how it was when they got there. She was literally face down in the grass. Mom was nowhere to be found. This is just a depiction of exactly how they found her. They were admitted over the objection because he says that they depict the scene when she arrived and they describe her testimony. So it's not of such nature that they are more prejudicial than probative. So they're admitted and they're shown to the jury. They talk about the blisters on Christina's skin and how it was down to raw skin. And they said that Rita was inside. Larry was walking around the yard. When Agent Godley went inside to talk to Rita, she said that she was basically in a room that was kind of just past the living room. And she was just pacing around. So she brought her outside and she said that Rita told her that she put Christina in the car, went inside to get cigarettes, came back out, and the doors were locked. Obviously, we know that's not what happened, and we'll hear more about this later. Cross-examinations don't really add much to any of this testimony. They do say that when she spoke to Larry, that he seemed panicked, but not necessarily upset. And during the cross-examination with Rita's attorney, they said that Rita got her out of the car, but she said you didn't observe how he acted when that happened. Basically saying that she may have just been pacing around the living room when she arrived, but when Christina was actually removed from the car, Agent Godley wasn't there to see if she was distraught or how upset she was. So he just wants to point out to the jury that maybe this isn't the testimony to kind of make a decision about how she was reacting. There's a few more quick witnesses. The state calls Charles Jones. He's a firefighter and paramedic for Colleton County. He was another one of the first on the scene, and he says that Christina was not breathing and she had no pulse when he arrived and no heartbeat. The state also calls Todd Schenck. He is a crime scene investigator for SLED. He shows a diagram of the house and the yard, where the car was, where Christina was, etc. And he says that when searching the car, they found a 9mm handgun and a Tupperware full of cigarettes. So there goes the story about going inside to get cigarettes. He also says that he collected tubes of blood from both defendants. This is stuff that we'll hear more about later. There are a few more witnesses that are called in as basically just foundation witnesses. So the tubes of blood, when they're collected, they don't just test them right there on the scene. They're passed through and they need to present the chain of command so that they can't just say that this was, you know, somebody else's blood or somebody tampered with it. So they have to bring in what they call foundational witnesses just to show that the blood that was taken from them is the blood that was tested and those are the results that we're hearing. So they bring in Kelly Padgett from Colleton County Sheriff's Department, who took them to the hospital and collected the blood. The state calls Spencer Stevens, who worked at Colleton Medical Center in the emergency department, and he is the one who actually drew the blood from Larry King. They call a deputy from Colleton County Sheriff's Office, who collected the vials of Larry's blood. And on cross, the one thing they wanted to point out, now keep in mind, this is just the dude that's collecting the vials of blood, but on cross-examination, they wanted to bring this out because apparently at some point he spoke to Larry, and Larry had told him that day that Rita would never hurt her daughter. He says he's not really sure. He doesn't really remember that, but they wanted to get it in there anyway. Another quick one in and out is Matthew Hoag. He is a toxicology specialist for SLED. SLED agent Lindsay Mitchell, who did the lab testing on the blood, and she's an expert in forensic toxicology. Brooklyn Molina, who assisted in taking photos of the blood vials and things like that. She also did the preliminary drug screen. Now, she's an expert in forensic psychology, and she says that on Rita's preliminary drug screen, it showed methamphetamine and amphetamine, and on Larry's, it also showed positive for methamphetamine and amphetamine. Now, on cross-examination, they tried to kind of get some technical stuff in here. During Larry's cross, they said if you do a preliminary and it's positive, is it sent to someone else for confirmatory testing or for class-specific testing or higher levels of testing? So they kind of explained how that works. And she said, yeah, it's basically just a different higher level of testing. This is just preliminary. And then on Rita's cross, it starts this whole three-day thing that he brings up every single time. So he says, could it have been several days before when the blood was taken that she was actually using? If it's in the bloodstream, then it could have been 3 days before. And she says it's possible, but if it's in the bloodstream, it is acting on the individual. The attorney told her, don't go outside of her scope. Guess you shouldn't ask questions if you don't know what the answer is going to be. The next two witnesses are pretty interesting. The first is Lindsay Lewis. She is a former babysitter for Christina. In August of 2019, she was only 18 years old. Rita was actually her child development teacher, and she said that she went to meet Rita and talk to her about Christina's care because she was actually supposed to be watching her. She's going to start babysitting. She said that she was going to be a nurse, so she thought that this was a good idea for her to help out and kind of give her some experience. She said that Christina wasn't able to walk, but she could kind of crawl around on her hands and knees, kind of like an infant. She said that she couldn't fully grasp things and she was nonverbal, but she would babble. She just couldn't formulate like actual words. But she said she would smile and she did show emotion. She said that Christina had a certain way that she needed to be cleaned and she had to have her diapers changed. She said that she got there around noon, 1 o'clock, something like that, and she kind of went over this entire routine with Rita. Then Rita asked if she would watch Christina while she went on a date with Larry. She said it was going to be about 5 or 6 o'clock that night. Now, this is on August 2nd of 2019, so this is just days before the actual death. She agreed to keep Christina while Rita went on her date with Larry, and she said that this was on a Friday.
Tell me about that. She left the house, I'm assuming, sometime around that afternoon?
Yes, sir. I would say about like around 5, 6 o'clock that afternoon, she left.
Anybody else there to take care of Christina?
No, sir.
Just you?
Mm-hmm.
Had you taken care of Christina before?
No, sir.
This was on what day?
This, the second. Yes, sir.
What day was that?
A Friday.
Did you see Rita Pangalanan again?
Not until Sunday afternoon.
After she went on a date with Larry, did she say, I'm gone and I'll be back Monday or anything like that?
She said that she texted me later that night to check on Christina, I would say about 9:30, 10 o'clock. And then she said she would be back the next morning on Saturday to go grocery shopping and stuff like that, but she never came. And
were there groceries in the house?
No, sir.
Just the insured drinks?
Mm-hmm. And I think there was a pitcher of Kool-Aid in there, maybe in the fridge.
So you heard her. She left on a Friday and did not come back until Sunday. Now, she said that there were no groceries in the house. There were some Ensure drinks and she thinks a pitcher of Kool-Aid. She said she didn't come back at all on Saturday and she didn't even call, actually. She said that she finally got in touch with Rita through Facebook that day, and Rita had said that Larry got sick with food poisoning, so she needed to stay and take care of him. It blows my mind that she thought that it was important for her to stay and take care of a grown man who had food poisoning instead of her special needs daughter who was with somebody for apparently an entire weekend, unplanned, who had never taken care of her before and didn't know her routine. It was food poisoning. Allegedly. Lindsay said she never did actually find out whether or not Larry was even sick, but it was around 5 or 6 Sunday when Rita finally came home. One other thing, she said that when she was putting Christina to bed, she noticed that there were markings on her, and she later found out that these were actually bed bug bites. Cross-examination, once again, did a whole lot of nothing. They asked about Christina knowing Lindsay before from the classroom when Rita would bring her in, and she said that in the classroom there were no concerns, everyone felt safe. Now, he also brought up something about there not being any groceries and there's only Ensure drinks, and he asked if Rita had ever told Lindsay that it's a choking hazard for Christina to have solid foods, that she can't tolerate solid foods because she would choke to death, and she said no, she never told me that. Now, okay, if this were the case, I could understand this. But y'all know that I am nosy and I've done some digging, and there are pictures on Facebook that say otherwise. There's actually a picture on Rita's Facebook of Christina with a chocolate donut, feeding herself a chocolate donut. So I don't think that this is the accurate truth. Next on the stand is Brittany Honeycutt. Now, this is one of the testimonies that they tried to keep out. Defense did not want this in. They did not want the jury to hear this. And I was wondering about why, and then she got on the stand and let us know. Brittany said that she met Rita through an ex-boyfriend when she moved into Rita's house on Academy Road. She said that she would pay Rita rent for staying there with her two kids, and she said she only lived there from May to August 1st. So it was the Thursday before Christina's death. Now, she said that she saw Christina every day, that she was really quiet and she would play with her toys. You knew she was there, but she wasn't really a bother. She was just very quiet. She said that she would show emotions and she would smile. Rita would ask her to watch Christina by herself a few times. She said that she did it, but it was usually just for a few hours. Basically, you had to kind of make sure her diaper was clean, had Kool-Aid in her cup, that type of thing. Then Brittany tells us about a time when Rita was asking her to watch Christina. She said that she asked her kind of over and over, and Brittany kept telling her, no, I can't. I have to work.
Rita came up to me and had asked me if I could watch her. I had let her know that I had to go into work for a few hours. So when I told her the first time, she kept asking me over and over again. And when she realized that the answer was not going to change from no, she had told me that I could still take her and leave her in my car with the windows down, and because she does it all the time. Because she does it all the time.
She be
Rita.
Hearing Brittany say that Rita had told her, just take Christina with you and leave her in the car with the windows down, I do it all the time, that's really concerning, and that's why they didn't want the jury to hear her testimony. Now, a lawyer's going to do what a lawyer's going to do. So, of course, Rita's attorney gets up during cross-examination, and he comes out swinging. He wants to discredit Brittany so that the jury doesn't believe what she says.
Rita kicked you out of the house right before all this happened. Is that right?
It was more of I was moving. I had already had a house set up.
Well, that's your opinion. She kicked you out of the house because you weren't paying rent, and you brought bed bugs into her home. Is that fair to say?
No, sir.
And you also moved your boyfriend into the home with his whole family. Y'all had a very toxic relationship, and you were in her home, not paying rent, correct?
I do not agree with that, no.
No further questions.
I told y'all he came out swinging. Now, he does not want the jury to hear this. This is obviously really bad for his client. So, he moves for a mistrial. He says that this has become about her mothering and things that aren't relevant, and that these things that happened previously are unduly prejudicial, and he moves for a mistrial. The state's response is the treatment of Rita's daughter is part of this, and it has been approved, you know, in previous motions. The movement for mistrial was denied. No big surprise there. Next up, Dr. Andrew Grunstein. He's a doctor of climatology. He studies weather and climate, and he's currently a professor at UGA. Go Dawgs! Doctor gives us a basic understanding of heat and heat index and how it's harder for sweat to evaporate when there's extreme heat, so you feel more heat stress in those situations. He talks about sunlight and temperature and humidity and how all of those things affect it. He says that the inside of the car is a totally different environment than the outside. He said that cars operate kind of like a greenhouse. The sunlight is coming in and it's producing heat that is just building up inside of the car because it doesn't have anywhere to go. He describes the cabin temperature in the car. He said that it probably reached a max of around 118 degrees. The dew point was around 74, which would make the heat index in the car around 135 degrees. Y'all, that poor child was in a car that was a heat index of 135 degrees, and she was in there for almost 6 hours. Cross-examination is a whole lot of nothing, but they both are basically trying to say that the air conditioner was on. So they're asking him questions about if he assumed that the air conditioner wasn't on when he was doing his testing, about how he got the temperatures of the inside and the heat index of the inside of the cabin of the car. And he says that he assumed that it wasn't on, and he bases it on energy gains and losses. He said that there's no way that Christina would have had 108 internal body temperature with the air running. He also says that that 109.9 that they originally tested her at, the temperature, that's as high as their thermometer would go. The defense attorney also makes a comment about how he's basically just making an educated guess, right? And he said, no, this is science. I like this doctor, and not just because he's a Georgia Bulldog. All right, so the final witness of the day, the state calls Captain Jason Chapman from Colleton County Sheriff's Office. Now, he comes up and he talks about the Night Owl camera system with four active cameras on it. He says that it was in a cabinet below the TV monitor, and it was set up at Larry King's house. He said that they were able to tell the timing of things based on seeing when the officers arrived and comparing the times of those things that they knew to the time that was on the actual security cameras. So they knew that the timing on everything was accurate and correct. He said that the DVR is set to motion activation. It records 15 seconds before the motion and 30 seconds after the motion. Now, the first motion of the entire day when Larry and Rita go outside is not until 11:16 a.m. So there are no other times on the cameras where they are shown exiting the house at all. They play the surveillance video for the jury, and it doesn't have any audio. We're just watching. And keep in mind, it's also motion activated. So there are, you know, bits and pieces here and there where it kind of jumps from time to time. But It's probably one of the most impactful silences that the jury could have had. The entire time that they're watching this video, and the video is condensed because of the time, you know, the timer going off. So it wasn't the full, you know, 5 hours and 45 minutes or whatever it was. This is only 4 hours and something, but they're sitting there in silence watching this, knowing that the entire time that they are watching this video, whether something's happening or it's not, whether they're seeing Rita and Larry on the front porch making out and hanging out on the porch swing and all of that stuff, or they see them inside the house for hours, whatever it is that's happening, they know that this entire video that they are watching, that child is in that hot car. I've broken the video down into a time frame, like a timeline, so I can kind of give you an idea of what they're seeing. 11:16 a.m., Rita and Larry exit the house. Larry is holding Christina, and they open the back driver's side door to Rita's car, and he puts Christina inside. They shut the door, and Rita and Larry continue to talk for 27 minutes. They look like they're arguing, but then they kind of want to make up. She looks like she's pleading to him. He kisses her on the forehead a couple times, but he's also waving his arms around, and you can tell that he's upset. The story about Larry finding out about Rita's infidelity pops into my head at this point because I figure it makes sense seeing their behavior and their body language towards each other. It makes sense that that could be what they're fighting about. After 27 minutes, they walk back inside the house. They're in the house for 46 minutes before the door opens again. Rita comes out at 12:29. She walks to the car. She kind of checks inside of it. She looks like she opens the front door. She's out there for about 3 minutes total. Now, during this time, you see something in Rita's hand, and it looks like it could be her keys or key fob. And it looks like she tosses it in the back seat. When she walks back inside, she is inside for another hour and 13 minutes before they come back out. So at this point, we're at 2.5 hours that Christina has been sitting in this car. They're out on the porch talking for about 18 minutes. At 2:03, they walk back in the house, and they're back inside the house for another hour. At 3:01 p.m., they walk back on the porch. They're talking on the porch for about 2 minutes. At 3:03 p.m., almost 4 hours later, they finally walk over to the car and try to open the doors, and it looks like it's locked. She's tugging on the handles. She walks to a different door. He walks inside at 3:05 p.m., and then she goes in shortly after. The fact that it took 3 hours and 45 minutes for them to leave her in the car and for them to realize that she's now apparently locked in the car, it's so disturbing. And the fact that they're just talking and hanging out and she's sitting there. Now, they said that the car was cranked, but there's no evidence of that. There's never any time on the camera where you see either of them crank it. Now, if it's one of the remote start cranks, you never see the lights come on for that. There's never any time where you see them crank the car at all. 2 minutes after Larry walks in the house at 3:07 p.m., he shows up on the back camera and he has a cup in his hand and he's walking to the back shed. She shows up on the front camera and she's kind of walking around the yard area, just kind of, it looks like she's just kind of moseying along, no sense of urgency or panic or concern. At 3:09, so about 2 minutes later, she wanders around back and he's still in the shed area, so she walks over to the shed. They walk from the shed toward the front of the house through the side yard at 3:11. At 3:13, he walks to the car with what looks like a coat hanger and it looks like he's trying to open it. It doesn't work, so he walks to the passenger side to try. He looks like he gives up on that and he's looking at the car, kind of looking inside, and they're basically just talking. Now, at 3:17, they walk up to the porch. She sits down and he does something on his phone while she just kind of sits there. At 3:18, they sit on the front porch swing and she's just kind of rubbing his back while he's scrolling on his phone. They get in touch with someone. Based on other reports, it looks like it's probably the locksmith, who we will hear from later, but he gets in touch with someone and he talks first and then he hands her the phone. At 3:26, it looks like he's off the phone, but they're still on the swing. It kind of looks like they're arguing. So she's back messing with his phone and swinging, and they're just sitting there like swinging on the front porch swing like nothing is happening. It's the most bizarre video. About 15 minutes pass and they go inside. At 3:38, they go to his car out back. She gets in the passenger side and he kind of hangs around the passenger seat where she's at for a while with the door open. About 3 minutes later, He's standing at the driver's side door, but he's not getting in. And you can tell he's doing something, but it's hard to see because it's right at the edge of the video, so you can't really tell what he's doing. But he finally gets in his car and shuts the door at 3:48. So they were out at his car for about 10 minutes before they finally got in and shut the doors. They sit in the car for another 4 minutes before they pull out, and they are gone for 48 minutes. At 4:40 p.m., they finally pull back up. I mean, at this point, it's been about 5.5 hours. But they don't get out yet. They're in the car for another 4 minutes, just sitting there. I don't know if they're talking, if they're arguing. There was no sense of urgency. They weren't in any kind of hurry. They literally sat in his truck in the driveway for 4 minutes. At 4:45, they finally walk over to the car. They walk around and then back to the passenger, still looking in the windows. He hits the key fob, and you can see that the lights do flicker from the key fob. He's walking in circles around the car, and he walks back to his truck, gets his phone. They start hugging in the yard, because that seems like the time for this. He walks back to his truck again, and then they stand in his driver's side door area of his truck. At 4:52, she finally walks to the car by Christina's seat and then walks back to the truck again. About a minute later, does the same thing. And then she starts to kind of look panicked. Rita walks to the trunk and then the passenger side, and then neither of those open. She walks back over by Christina. That doesn't open. She goes back to the trunk. Now, at this point, Larry looks like he's on the phone. At 4:56, he walks over to the trunk. They're looking at the trunk. She looks inside the back passenger window and pulls on that door, but it doesn't open. Then they both put their hands on top of the car and start to shake it. Doesn't do anything. They finally walk back over to the driver's side where Christina was, and they open Christina's door. That door was opened at 4:58 p.m. She was put in that car at 11:16 a.m. 5 hours and 42 minutes in a hot car on a southern summer day. And Christina is finally out of the car. And she's gone. The state only has two more witnesses. Dr. Demi Garvin is brought in for toxicology. Now, she goes over the positive results for the methamphetamine and the amphetamine in both Rita and Larry's blood. Now, remember we heard about the preliminary test before, and Dr. Demi is the one who comes to explain the actual blood tests. So, in the blood samples, the unit to measure the drug is nanograms per milliliter. Now, they give a little bit of information about this. So, there's three basic levels. The first is therapeutic level, which is basically if the methamphetamine is being used for its stimulant effects for things like narcolepsy or weight loss or ADHD. In that case, the concentration would be around 10 to 50 nanograms per milliliter. The next level is misuse or abuse level. And the concentrations for this are generally around 200 nanograms per milliliter or above. The third level is the potentially fatal level. Now, there's going to be a little bit of overlap here because potentially fatal in one person might be different in another person because of various factors. But she said that the lower ends of this usually start around 300 nanograms per milliliter and go up. Rita's measurement was 400 nanograms per milliliter of methamphetamine and 160 nanograms per milliliter of amphetamine. So she has passed the abuse level and has entered into the potentially fatal level. Larry is at 480 nanograms per milliliter of methamphetamine and 88 nanograms per milliliter of amphetamine. So he also has past the abuse or misuse level and has entered into the potential fatality level. The doctor also points out something that I thought was really important here. These blood tests represent what is happening in real time. There are some back and forths between the defense attorneys and the doctor basically saying, well, this could be, you know, 3 days ago, right? That's the comment that I keep hearing with all of the drug stuff with the defense attorney. But what she's explaining is, yeah, it's possible that it was ingested 3 days ago, but that's not what's important here. This is a real-time depiction of how much was in your system working on you. She talks about some of the different effects that methamphetamine can have on you. You can become hypervigilant, where you stay on task or you become obsessed with something. You can be excitable. There's increased risk-taking behaviors, etc. Now, the opposite happens when you're coming down. You can feel very fatigued and depressed, looking for the next dose so that you feel good again. You might crash as opposed to being up for days or hours. It also affects cognitive abilities. You have decreased judgment and decreased critical thinking skills. Decision making is impacted. You have lessened ability to recognize consequences of actions and increased libido, which we already know about because they went inside to get it on while Christina was in the car. The cross-examination with Rita's attorney is the same thing it is every other time. It could have been 3 days ago, right? All of that mess. Now, the cross-examination with Larry's attorney, he brings up tolerance. He wants to point out that people can develop tolerance and are able to function at higher levels, even if they have higher doses of the drugs or alcohol or whatever it is in them, if they've built up tolerance. All right, the last witness for the state is the pathologist, Dr. Nick Batalis. He is the forensic pathologist who did the autopsy of Christina. We hear that the coroner reported the body temperature of 109.9, which we know is the max amount that that thermometer would read. He tells us that the body shuts down around 105 to 106 degrees, so there's going to be severe signs of hyperthermia at that range, especially up to 109.9. He says the cause of death is how the person died. The manner is how that cause came about. So the manner could be homicide, suicide, accident, natural, and undetermined. Those are the options for that. Now, he said that the cause of death in this case is hyperthermia, and the manner of death is homicide. Now, as far as the coroners and pathologists and anybody in that field, as far as they're concerned, homicide doesn't automatically mean that somebody murdered somebody else. Homicide in their field means that somebody died at the hand of another. In this case, Christina was placed into a hot car where she was trapped, so she died at the hand of another. That would be homicide. Next, the doctor goes over the autopsy diagram. This part's really sad. He talks about Christina, and she was only 58 pounds. She was 4'8". She suffered from cerebral palsy. He said that she was shorter, and her weight is less than the average 13-year-old. But what's sad is he talks about the damage that was done to her while she was dying. There's skin slippage, which is where skin has blistered so bad that it's starting to pull away from the body. This means that basically decomposition has started processing. He shows on the diagram the multiple spots on her body where this has happened. Then there are other lesions where things came into contact with her skin and caused burns. She also, at some point, vomited on herself. Hearing the torture that she went through is absolutely heartbreaking. Cross-examination gets a little bit spicy. Larry's attorney tries to question the doctor about how, if he didn't have any history about what had happened, would he still have come to that conclusion? And he gets pretty rude with him, honestly. He asks about this being an undetermined cause instead of homicide. And the doctor said, well, it's not undetermined because there's burns on the body. They go back and forth, and he's basically trying to get him to say that it might not have been a homicide. If he got more information, then maybe it could have been altered later on, etc. But he was so rude with his delivery, the doctor just wasn't having it. Now, during Rita's cross, her attorney got up there and he had worked with a doctor before, and he told him that he didn't question his profession or his credentials. He was just basically wanting to point out that homicide just means at the hand of another, not necessarily murder or manslaughter or whatever. With the conclusion of the doctor's testimony, the state now rests their case. Larry and Rita's attorneys both ask the judge for a directed verdict. They're basically saying, you know what? They didn't present enough evidence to actually convict. You've heard what there is. Just go ahead and let us all go home instead of making this go to the jury. Just go ahead and direct the verdict to not guilty, acquit them. Let's all just go home and have supper. Of course, it's denied. Now, that's the end of this episode. On the next episode, we will have the defense's case, which includes both defendants actually taking the stand in their own defense. And you're not going to believe what they say. Now, if you want to dive a little bit deeper into these trials, check out the website. It's 13thjurorpodcast.com. That's 13thpodcast.com. I have pictures from the trial and pictures of who's involved and who's who. I also, for this trial, have some screenshots of the video surveillance where you can see the car and the porch and kind of get an idea of everything that we're talking about. So check that out. It's 13thjurorpodcast.com. I appreciate y'all listening, and please don't forget to subscribe, share, and leave us some reviews because they really help us out. So that's all I've got for today. Thank you for reporting to jury duty. My name is Brandi Churchwell, and I will see y'all next time.